Friends, hitherto in our studies of theosophy together for three meetings, we have concentrated upon the universal source of all worlds, the supreme deity in universe and in man, and those modes of divine manifestation throughout all nature and those beings, the hierarchy of the creative intelligences by whose aid divine thought is made manifest in objective forms. This has been our study up to now, and generally, by, it's called the macrocosm, a Greek word, the great world, the great universe. Now we descend, wrongly, we descend only metaphysically and diagrammatically from the universal to the particular, from the one Godhead of all to the presence of that same Godhead as the supreme deity within each and every human being, the divine in each one of us, for example. And this the Greeks called the microcosm, or the small world. And to this they added the macrocosm and the microcosm are one. We are, however, mentally still in the realms of metaphysical thinking, and we must stay there for a while as we this evening study together the purely spiritual part of man's nature, the unit of spirit essence, which is the dweller in the innermost of each and every one of us. The words of St. Paul came to my mind then. He put it, "Know ye not that ye are the temple of the living God, and that the Spirit of God dwelleth in you?" Our study. So we learn from theosophy, the age-old wisdom, that man is not only just a physical, emotional, and intellectual being. In his real nature, man is a spiritual entity capable of developing and expressing compassionately capacities for the exercise of powers. Powers of spiritual will, spiritual wisdom, and abstract intelligence. And this is sometimes called the triple spiritual self of man. In its turn, an expression of the one central spirit essence, which is at the very heart of human nature. So I would think myself that our subject is perhaps the most directly vastly important to the individual student, because we have to concern ourselves with man himself, and especially, yes, with the undying, eternally enduring and unfolding spiritual identity of each and every one of us. Indeed, yes, of every human being. Wonderful thought, isn't it? I repeat that. The undying, eternally enduring and unfolding spiritual identity of every human being, the real self, of which this is a temporary, physical, emotional and mental expression. Now to that, again the Greeks coined a word, monad, the monad, our subject. Literally it means the one, or alone even. So we might say, the one alone. Or, if one tries to define it, it's really beyond definition. The divine spirit in man, or as I used a term just now, didn't I? The dweller in the innermost. And this dweller in the innermost is said to evolve through the subhuman kingdoms of nature into the human, and thence to the stature of superhumanity, the adept, and beyond, into unlimited and up to unlimited evolutionary heights. Wonderful thought which theosophy puts before us. This indwelling spirit essence within each one of us is slowly, in our time, unfolding inherent potentialities through the subhuman, human, into the adeptic kingdoms of nature and beyond, to unlimited degrees or heights. Again, I remember Madame Blavatsky says, this stupendous development has neither conceivable beginning nor imaginable end. This is the unfoldment of the unit or monad of spirit essence, the real identity in each one of us. It's described as both the source of man's forthgoing at the beginning of divine manifestation and, yes, the home to which all return. Or as they say in Zen Buddhism, enlightenment is the returning home. The real home. One's veriest, deepest, inmost self. Home. The monad may also be thought of as a radiating center and source of white light, or if you wish, an interior spiritual sun. And so our thoughts, you see, are led beyond and within the mortal, personal nature, beyond, yes, our purely intellectual nature, and into the spiritual center and heart of every human being. Or as we read in our Bible, text comes to me as I say these things. God created man to be immortal. In the image of his own eternity, created he him. The real self. Next, I think we ought to remember, and I ought to say, as exponent, that the monad is not a far away, distant being. It's not only one's very selfhood, but it is represented by its power and its life and its consciousness in each and every part of us. We are monadic beings, or expressions with varying degrees of perfection and imperfection of the divine. We could almost say to ourselves, could we? The monad is you, and you are the monad. The monad is yourself, and yourself is the monad. Really? Yes. That's the whole purpose of contemplation of the divine, of yoga, to know by direct experience, not in theory, not in words, not even in thought, but as a blazing interior elevation and light. The monad is yourself. You are the monad, the center of the spirit essence of the universe. And this, friends, this what we mistake for our real selves is but a mask. You're not seeing me, you know, at all. And I'm not seeing you. This is a mask in the sense of a covering, you see. A body through which we can meet each other, see each other, converse, feel, think, and intuit, and so on. But not the real self. The intuiting, intellect, being. And the whole purpose, if I may just turn aside for a moment, of yoga is to know that. Not as theory, but as an unchanging and continuing experience. To be one with God and through him with all that lives. And so the Indian yogis express it otherwise in Sanskrit. Aham evam param brahmam. Verily, I am that supreme Brahman. Deity. Well, now from this theoretical level, let us come nearer to our study from the more mental point of view. And to help us in this, I brought a chart. And Sandra will call only a chart representing in diagrammatic form only, not factually, this our subject, the spiritual selfhood in its vehicles. And I want to make it clear that all such illustrations of levels of being and of awareness, from highest spirit to lowest matter, these actually falsify the situation. They're wrong. They are, however, very helpful as modes of classification and aids to remembrance. For in reality, there is neither up nor down, nor here nor there, for the totality of the universe is inherent in every atom of existence everywhere. However, for studying particular levels of density of matter from very tenuous spiritual substance down to our densest, we put it in chart form to help us to understand. Thus, the divine presence and the human monad are not above their physical embodiment, but within, and therefore present. The triangle may be used to illustrate this idea. The great symbol of the threefold deity generally is the equilateral triangle. Whether we say Father, Son, or Holy Ghost, or power, wisdom, and intelligence, or whatever our language may be, Atma, Buddhi, Manas in Sanskrit, it's triadic. Whether in the universe as a whole or in man. And so I'm using the triangular form. But I ask you to notice that the apex is not closed. Deliberately, to suggest infinity, and that I in no sense presume to add any kind of finite to that which is beyond all such limitations. Then you'll see the triangle, the small one, which is the monad which we are studying. And since it is itself a manifestation of the divine, it is well expressed as a minor triangle. So we have the threefold, transcendent and immanent deity manifested as the human monad. And we are reminded by what is written there, all is within. Not up there, but within. We're in the divine presence now, here in this room, in this hall, at this moment, as close as ever we can possibly be. Of course, this brain and these eyes and everything shut it out, but it's there. And the whole purpose, really, and secret of success in religion is to know that. To know that. Or as the Lord Tennyson put it, speak to him thou, for he hearest, and spirit with spirit can meet. Closer is he than breathing, nearer than hands and feet. Just here and within. So the divine presence and the human monad in relation to their bodies are not above their embodiment, but within, and therefore present. And the triangle I've chosen, yes, to represent and illustrate this idea. And the angles at the base are necessarily at the greatest distance from each other. So on the physical plane we have geography. Distance, here. Not here and over there. But at the monadic level, at the apex, these concepts are without meaning. Since all is here in fullness all the time. then the monad is manifested in those ways that you see. Spiritual well, Atma in Sanskrit, spiritual wisdom, man's Christ nature, or his vehicle of intuitive insight, his spiritual intelligence or manas, where he has a vehicle we'll be studying next time, man in his immortal vehicle, the causal body. And then here, where we are in our personalities, those three ovals, the concrete mind, the mental body, the emotions, our astral body, to use a familiar term, and the physical body. Then you see the kind helper has drawn a shaft direct down from the monad through all of these levels and all these bodies which are, as it were, threaded upon this thread of life or sutratma. Like, yes, like pearls upon a single silken thread. Now we will, by the by, in the course of the studies I'm privileged to carry out with you, we will study each of these vehicles as time goes on. Now, in order to gain a little more understanding, if I may so presume, of our subject, the monad, I have chosen some of the titles, many of which have been given to the monad. Perhaps by a study of the titles, thank you, Sandra, we can look at them together and understand. What are some of the titles which the writers and teachers and scriptural authors have given to this wonder of wonders, which is the divine, eternal spirit essence, which is the real identity of you and me and of all beings, the monad? Some of them may be familiar to you. The spark within the one flame. There you have an association with the sun. The spiritual sun, really. Our Lord, the sun. For whom the physical sun is but a lens and a center of radiation. Man, as monad, being as a spark within the one flame. Did you notice I've altered the sentence? We generally say, don't we, spark of the one flame. An error, because that suggests flying out. Sparks fly out. Never do you. In our essential individuality, nor will we ever spring out from or leave that which is our source. Spark within the one flame. What else? Breath of the great breath. Ah, there you have a reference to the outbreathed power of God by which all things are brought into being. Or as it says, God breathes up and the universes come into existence. He breathes in and all is withdrawn back into the source. A man is a breath of the great breath, some of the teachers say. Madame Blavatsky goes back to the sun and says of the monad, it is a scintilla of the spiritual sun. Scintilla, same thing as spark. A minute, shining, radiant, yes, spark's the best word perhaps, scintilla of the spiritual sun. But within, of course. Another, rather similar, the white brilliance. You might like to meditate a bit as I say these things. Think in the middle of the head, for everything is here and now. The white brilliance. The manifestation of the divine. Our true selves, for which this, as St. Paul says, is a temple. The white brilliance. One I've repeated, I say it again, the dweller in the innermost, seated in the heart of all being. Ah, it's a wonderful truth. There is a divine dweller in the innermost of all being, which makes us one, of course, seated in the heart of all being. Again, the illumined one is the one who's moved into that realization. All are one. The dweller in the innermost. Another, the self-radiant divine fragment. I like that one. The self-radiant divine fragment. That's Greek. They have in Greek, orgoides, meaning, referring to the monad, as the self-radiant divine fragment. Again, careful. Don't think of the fragment as being separate, or the spark as flying out, or the scintilla of existing by itself, but a shining center, you see. The self-radiant divine fragment. What else? The logos of the soul. Here we are in the realm of the concept of the divine as the creative. The Word, as St. John puts it. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was God. And the Word was with God. And by Him were all things made that were made. And without Him was nothing made that was made. And His life was and is the light of man. In Sanskrit, the logos, in Greek, the logos of the soul. Or in Sanskrit, I nearly went on there, here's a very strange one, but so true. I've collected these to bring the dwarf Purusha. Purusha means breath. And so, sometimes the supreme creative power, not as a being, but as a principle in existence, the supreme creative principle throughout all cosmoi is referred to in its masculine sense, Purusha. And they say, wonderfully, I think, in Hindu cosmogony, within the heart of every human being, there resides a dwarf Purusha. Wonderful way of putting it, you see. In fact, these writers of old have done all they can to help us to overstep the limitations of our concrete minds and perhaps begin to realize something of the divine truth. Another name, by a very great Indian yogi, the witness. He says of the yogi, he peels the sheath from the spiritual self one by one, and what remains is the witness. Meaning, according to the chart, he ascends in consciousness, free of his physical body, astral, mental body. His consciousness is focused far and far more subtle level, free of his causal. I am not my buddhic vehicle. I am not the Atma. I am the witness watching all. And that really, thank you, is really what yoga is, you know. It's transcending all the vehicles. And the yogi and the meditating and contemplating human being seeks to rise, saying, I'm not the body, the emotions and the mind. I am the divine spirit essence abiding within them, the witness. More? Yes, I've collected a few more. The immortal germ. Oh, that's a wonderful one. Because you see, a germ has in it potentially everything that is going to be produced. And so the monad is correctly described as an immortal germ, because it contains within itself the total potentiality of all the powers that will ever, ever be developed. They're there, potentially, germinally, if you like. And so the great teachers have referred to the monad very, very wonderfully, I always think, as the immortal germ. In Christianity, the Christ indwelling. St. Paul again, strongly drawing our attention to the Christ in you, as he put it, the hope of glory. So all of these and other titles, they all, in a way, falsify, but may help us as we seek to gain understanding beyond the level of conceptual thought, in the region of our power for abstract intellectual perception, something of this mysterious divinity within us. There is, in fact, I use that word then, not thinking what I was coming to, there is a kind of, yes, mysterious conversation about the monad. Let me repeat it to you. Some ancient seer wrote it. What is it? Nameless. Where is it? Everywhere. How can you measure it by everywhereness only? Nameless, everywhere, in everywhereness. Never mind if the mind won't have it. I know it won't. That's the point. That's the whole point of spiritual awareness, friend. The mind won't have everywhereness. Or, as Madame Blavatsky puts it of the monad, and deity, that which has its center everywhere and its circumference nowhere. Ah, the old man says, don't talk nonsense to me, it can't be. Oh, yes, it can, and it is. But we have to transcend our limitations. When is it? Always. Whence came it? It ever existed. Who is it? Everyone. How much of it exists? Allness. So you see, friends, to the mind, the monad must ever be a profound mystery. It's supramental. And they tell us that it is only in mental stillness will the monad ever discover itself to the meditating yogi. Or, yes, as the Lord God itself said to the psalmist, be still and know that I am God. The whole of yoga in one sentence. Be still. That means be still from the purely concrete mental activity and let in the next level. I am that, that am I. Later on, we'll be studying all this in some detail, particularly descriptions of what happens when you touch this. What's it like? Well, of course, the seers and the poets and the prophets have repeated their experiences. Here's one. There is a flash of radiance from the Godhead. And one is blissfully unified with all that lives. I almost want to stop there. There is a flash of radiance from the Godhead, and one is blissfully unified with all that lives. A kind of glory lights up the mind. Then a man pours out a torrent of himself, yet is not diminished. See, people have tried and tried to express the inexpressible. Dante expresses his tranquility and exaltation in these words. That he must have touched, you see, this level of consciousness. Because he wrote, that which I was seeing seemed to me to be a smile of the universe. For my inebriation was entering through the hearing and through the sight. Oh joy, oh ineffable gladness, O life entire of love and peace, O riches secure without longing, he wrote, trying with words, 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 which falsify reality, to state the wonder of the inner monadic consciousness. Now let me sum it all up. As we draw this study to a close, since I do not wish to continue too long what I know is a difficult subject, though not new to many of you. Theosophy teaches something like this, leaving us all quite free, there being no dogmas, only proffered ideas, with the suggestion that we should meditate upon them. Here are some. Man is essentially a spiritual being. His mind and his body are only temporary means of self-expression and self-unfoldment. When this true self is discovered and becomes the directing power, there is permanent peace for the individual and for the race. Without that discovery, peace is impossible. The search for and the discovery of the self is therefore of supreme importance. And I might add, yes, for the individual and for the race. Why? Well, because the moment the self is discovered, the whole being cries out, all one, all one. Next we learn the evolution of the spiritual self to perfection through successive lives on earth is the true purpose of human existence. The evolution of the spiritual self to perfection through successive lives on earth is the true purpose of human existence. Next, very important now, friends. Man's experiences are decided by the operation of the law of cause and effect. I might add, the operation of the impersonal law of cause and effect. Cruelty brings war to nations and pain and disease to individuals. And there is no possible escape from this sequence. Inversely, kindness brings happiness and health. And until this law is recognized and accepted, yes, as a rule of life, there will continue to be both war and disease. If I may just interpolate, our Lord Christ accentuated this so strongly and so continually, saying, it is easier for heaven and earth to pass away than for one jot or one tittle of the law to fail. Judge not, that ye be not judged. Be merciful, that ye may obtain mercy. And whatsoever ye would that others should do unto you, do ye unto them also. And in what measure ye mete it out to others, in that measure shall it be meted out to you again. Then that marvelous utterance, for this is the law and the prophets. Marvelous teaching that if only mankind knew, would recognize, would accept, would live by. Kindness brings happiness and health. Cruelty brings war and disease. The Buddhist puts it, whenever and how do they put it? Whenever an intentional action is performed by a self-conscious individual, an appropriate reaction is always produced. Two more ideas, then I'll close, friends. The spirit within all men is one spirit. Each man belongs to one spiritual race, which is without divisions of any kind. Experience of this unity and its wise applications to human life constitute the only possible means whereby lasting peace can be established on earth and assured health and happiness be attained by every human being. Such, my friend, as I very limitedly understand it, such is part of the teaching of theosophy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hudson. Mr. Hudson would be pleased to answer any written questions you may have, and one of our young ladies will have pencils and paper if anybody wants it. And our last past year is just to wait.
When man reaches the divine and monadic planes, he's always there, friends. You mean in consciousness, don't you? When man is aware, may I presume, in the divine and monadic planes, would this be the point of no return? I mustn't presume to answer such a very lofty and far-reaching question. But, as far as my limited understanding goes, the answer should be no. Why? Well, because of what I quoted from Madame Blavatsky, this stupendous development has neither conceivable beginning nor imaginable end. So it goes on and on. But it does follow a cyclic path of forthgoing and return into manifestation, followed by a period of quiescence, succeeded by a further forthgoing and return at a somewhat more lofty and fuller degree of development, and so on and on. So that in toto, must answer you no, but of course, for a particular universe, there will be a time of temporary rest, or pralaya, which in a way is of no return. But not fully, not fully. The whole evolutionary procedure continues cyclically, without end. Or if you like, yes, a spiral ascent. Or, yes, if you like, a pendulum swing down into full manifestation, deepest density of matter for our earth, the mineral, slowly back to to the other extreme of the swing, the most tenuous spiritual substance, until the whole of the evolutionary procedure has reached its highest, then a stillness or quiet. Then again, the swinging of the pendulum recurs. That's wrong too, but it's the best I can do. Thank you for a very interesting question. I suppose I might go a little further. With due respect to the Brahmavidya, there does come a time, of course, a point of no return in this sense, that when once the stature of perfected manhood has been reached, or as St. Paul put it, the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, then there will never be a return to the limitations of purely human existence. Evolution has carried the monad beyond that, and that in a way there will be no return to the sub-adept and subhuman states of existence. In that sense, if you like, yes. But nowhere is there a final silence and, dare I say, terminus. As far as my studies go. Would you please indicate what importance present-day research into parapsychology holds for us? I shall be dealing with this whole subject a little later on. It will come in. It belongs to the third object for which the Theosophical Society was founded 98 years ago, to investigate the hidden forces of nature and the hitherto unexplained powers latent in man. These powers do exist, and as we learn to use astral, mental, causal, intuitive, and atmic consciousness, so we transcend the limitations of our five senses. So in this sense, parapsychology points to evolutionary future. And one notices, probably it's a sign of the times through which we are now passing, that there's a great deal of interest at this time. In many countries of the world, and many experiments, as you know, including in Russia, into this field. Mental telepathy, clairvoyance, clairaudience, precognition, leaving the body, dreaming true. In all these ways, a certain interest in parapsychology is showing itself, foreshadowing the time, I suggest, when man, as he is today, will have evolved beyond para, his present limitations of five senses, and the psychology they produced. So yes, it's all in line with the evolutionary progress of man. He'll progress through powers of consciousness appropriate to those vehicles. I would like to just utter a warning. There are dangers associated with parapsychology. And on the whole, I would rather warn those who are undertaking attempted personal development along those lines to make sure that they are being guided by a person of knowledge and wisdom. There are dangers. You can strain, injure, hurt the body, the brain, very seriously. I know this because as I travel the world with Sandra, and she will confirm, so often we are consulted by people who have done that very thing, been experimenting with yoga and parapsychology, mind developments, and even drugs, mind-expanding drugs in this direction. Very dangerous, and have got into very serious trouble. So, wisely practiced and under an experienced teacher, then some benefit might occur. When colour is seen, what is the meaning of the colours? That is a subject I'll be lecturing on also. But you will find them all given and interpreted in my book, Lecture Notes of the School of the Wisdom. So if you care to look that up in the library, you'll find a list of the colours, and as they are in the aura and surrounding people and their possible meaning. Yellow, for example, the lemon yellow, the activities of the intellect. Green, emerald green, compassion, sympathy, tenderness. Roseate glow, love, pure love. Brown, selfishness. Brick red, sensuality. Lavender, often over the head, idealism. Pure blue, devotion. But those are only a few. It's a much larger subject than that. Was Jesus actually seen as a bodily ascending, physical resurrection? Is a physical resurrection possible? Yes. I'm not saying yes to the event described in the Bible, which may be also symbolical. So we can't say there. Whether it's an ascent in consciousness, do you see, to higher levels of awareness, into the Godhood, to the right hand of God, as it says, or whether it was also a physical, what is called in this field of thought, levitation. That is possible to an adept. And since Jesus is presented to us in some measures as an adept, then it would be well within his powers thus to be levitated, yes. But as to, of course, what happened really, and how far we are to take the gospel story literally like that, that's left to each one of us, according to our temperament. Both would be possible. Descriptive of entering into, or falsely put, rising up diagrammatically into full realization of presence with the Supreme, or also levitating with the aura shining forth, as it says, in clouds of glory. That'll happen to all of us as we in our turn thus ascend. Thank you.